This is Charlotte Frascona. It's Friday, November 12th, and I'm interviewing Professor Paula Voos at Rutgers University as part of the Oral History Project for the Industrial Relations Research Institute. Paula, can you talk a little bit about your educational and professional background, where you did your undergraduate and graduate work, and what positions you've held?
Yes. I have a bachelor's degree from Whitman College, which is a small liberal arts school in Eastern Washington, a master's degree from Portland State University, and a doctoral degree from Harvard University. I have, as a professor, taught both at the University of Wisconsin and now at Rutgers.
Okay. And all your degrees were in economics?
No, my bachelor's degree was in English, and my master's and PhD were in economics.
Okay. What was the focus of your dissertation?
It was union organizing programs, costs, and benefits.
Okay. And why did you choose that topic?
I find it hard to answer that question, so if we'd like to, we can circle back to it.
Okay. Well, can you talk about what you're currently doing in terms of research?
Yes. One of my research projects has resulted in a series of papers. It involves the representation of supervisors and lower-level managers, both through unions and alternative forms of employee representation. And as part of that, I've been concerned with the law and changes in the law that affect professionals like nurses who have some managerial or supervisory responsibilities sometimes. I also have a stream of research that looks at changes in union wages over time as union membership has dwindled in the United States. I'm trying to address the question of whether or not that's resulted in a decline in union bargaining power.
Hmm. And what led to your interest in IR?
Again, I find that one hard to answer, so why don't we circle back to that?
Okay. When did you become involved with the IRI at Wisconsin?
I joined the IRI when I was hired as an assistant professor in 1981. My appointment was three quarters in the economics department and one quarter in the institute, and I joined Wisconsin. I accepted that position precisely because of the IRI.
Oh, okay. So when you were at Portland State and at Harvard, there was not an IR program for you to be connected to?
I did a dissertation in basically the IR field, but it was part of the economics department.
Okay.
I mean, that's union organizing is definitely industrial relations. So mm-hmm. I was a labor economics major or specialist within the economics program, and John Dunlop was my chair, and that, of course, is his specialty.
Mm. Okay. So you came to Wisconsin in 1981 and joined IR at that point. What attracted you to the Institute?
I was hired as replacement for Jack Barbash, who, of course, was retiring at that time. He was still forced to retire at age 65. And so I was explicitly a replacement for him to teach IR theory and to carry on the work of the Institute. And I chose Wisconsin because, in fact, it had the IR program. My other job offers at really leading research universities, for example, were solely in economics. That was at University of Pennsylvania.
Mm.
Or they were much less good quality programs.
Mm. Okay. So the IR program had a strong reputation at that point.
It had extremely strong reputation, yes.
Okay. Can you say what in particular its strengths were in the early 80s?
It had a number of strengths. It had a large number of very dedicated faculty who were had tenure homes in other departments, but whose really main identity and interest was in industrial relations and its students. It had a long history of graduating excellent PhD students, and so some of the leading industrial relations scholars elsewhere in the United States were from the University of Wisconsin and sent it as master's students and, really kind of carried on its reputation through their publishing, scholarly research. It had an active and involved alumni organization, which were more local or more local individuals. It had, a really good quality PhD program as well as a good quality master's program.
Okay. Did your involvement with the Institute change during the years you worked at UW?
Well, obviously, yes, because initially I was an assistant professor, and as I said, I was quarter-time in the Institute. When I became tenured at Wisconsin and became promoted to associate professor, the percentage of my appointment changed to 50% in the Institute, and I took a greater role at that time, and eventually became the director of the Institute, which I, really devoted a lot of time to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a director, you had an opportunity to provide vision for the Institute and to shape it, and you were director, I believe, from 93 to 98, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Correct. So what were the IRI's strengths and during those 5 years that you served as director?
Well, I think they were the things I mentioned before. The body of faculty, it was somewhat smaller than it had been when I initially came in 1981 because there had been, there was gradually retirement of individuals like Jim Stern and other people who'd been very involved in the Institute over time. But there still was a core of remaining faculty who were really good quality. There still was a strong PhD program. I would mention a couple other strengths that I didn't mention before. One of the other strengths of the Institute was that the Industrial Relations Research Association was centered in Wisconsin. And I definitely worked with the association a lot. That was a strength. Another strength was that there was a really excellent PhD program in sociology and in economics and other. And I think that was very good for our PhD students. That's something that here at Rutgers is not as big a strength of the industrial relations program I'm involved with. Another strength was the School for Workers and the involvement of their faculty in the program. Wisconsin has a really excellent labor extension and a bigger one given the size of the state than many other states, and that was the strength of the Institute.
Okay. What was the tie with having excellent PhD programs in Soci and Econ? How did that connect?
Well, because it meant that IR PhD students, for example, could take methods classes, classes in sociology that would be then prepare them to do research. And for example, here that's not the case.
Oh, okay. So
I'm just comparing to Rutgers. I'm just saying that at Wisconsin, those programs provided many classes that our students could take and many faculty that would work with our students. So, for example, Joel Rogers in sociology could be on a dissertation, even though he was, not very involved in the Institute on a day-to-day basis. He was a faculty member that had interest in aspects of the field.
Oh, okay. Okay. So it enriched the curriculum and gave students more options.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. And what would you say the weaknesses of the program have been, not necessarily during your 5 years as director, but in general, in the 15 or 20 years that you were at Wisconsin?
Well, I think one thing that I've that happened while I was director is we had retiring faculty that we were not able to replace. And so the people who were involved in the Institute aged, and there became fewer of them over time. And sometimes a faculty member would be recruited, say, in the business school or elsewhere on campus and would join the Institute because of their research interests. But there just were not enough accretions. And the difference with Rutgers, since I came to Rutgers, we've hired virtually every year I've been here.
Wow.
And it's just very different being in a program where you have the capacity to hire and you have a continual infusion of younger scholars or excellent scholars who are mid-career from elsewhere in the United States that are joining your program and making it bigger and stronger every year, as opposed to basically in some ways the IR Institute was relying on its past history and it was getting thinner from the inside over time.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that when those faculty retired that IR was not able to replace them?
Well, I think that Wisconsin had the whole university was going through a number of fiscal problems at the time, so that, you know, related to the state budget, so that, in fact, it was not easy to hire faculty elsewhere. But I think it was also that the IRE Institute was not able to get the support from central administration to hire as it should have had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that related to its interdisciplinary nature rather than the fact that it was a department, and along with many other things.
So there was little support from central administration because it was an interdisciplinary program rather than a department?
I think that in Wisconsin, the big departments in FAS, whether they were chemistry or economics or sociology, all of the big departments, you know, felt that they would have more resources to hire and to build strong programs if the university devoted resources to hiring in those big, strong departments, not in interdisciplinary programs in general.
Hmm. So is that a problem that was faced by other interdisciplinary programs like Chicano Studies, Women's Studies, Environmental Studies?
My impression is it was, but I'm less of an expert at that than some other people you may talk to about the specifics at Wisconsin, but I do believe that nationwide, the industrial relations programs that have done best have been either ones that had their own school, as here at New Jersey, or in Illinois, or in Michigan State, or Minnesota, Michigan State, or have been part of a business school, as, for example, at the University of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Cornell, of course, is its the biggest and best, and it has its own school. And that also relates to generally the way things were at Wisconsin, and I've just really noticed the difference here. You know, at the University of Wisconsin, because you were in FAS, you were...
Letters and Science?
Oh, Letters and Science. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. It's called FAS here.
Mm-hmm.
Letters and Science. Okay, because you're in Letters and Science. The Institute, you know, for example, couldn't hire an adjunct instructor to teach a class. All they could do was write memos asking the folks who allocated resources in Letters and Science to give us resources to do that.
Right.
Here, the Institute could not run a program, for example, for a corporation, and make money that it then could use to give to graduate students or to promote itself. You know, at Wisconsin, we had virtually no promotional materials for students. We didn't create colorful posters that we sent out, or we didn't send out brochures. We did virtually no recruitment. This is completely different here. We run programs. We earn money. We hire faculty. We can do things, and it's just completely different.
So you have a lot more autonomy.
Complete autonomy. And so, for example, I can teach for General Motors United Automobile Workers, and they pay Rutgers School of Management Labor Relations. The school makes money. We have programs at Prudential Corporation, where we teach after work, and Prudential Corporation pays, you know, about twice the normal university tuition. We get to keep 85% of that, which we then use to what? To build our program.
Is that similar to what the School for Workers does here, where they have relationships?
Well, yes, except that School for Workers has been, you know, of course, is financially strapped because, of course, they're working with the labor movement, and that's not a particularly moneyed sector.
Right, right.
Right.
But it's the same kind of activity where they go out and they
have autonomy.
They're
right.
Teaching non-credit courses.
Right. Well, our courses are credit courses. So, for example, I started a whole program about 50 minutes away in Freehold, New Jersey, which has classes in the evening, and we get to keep 85% of the tuition. So each one of these classes a student pays about $600 for, and we get that money, and either we teach there or we hire adjuncts to teach there, and we make money.
Hmm.
And then we use that to do things.
I see. And you can use it for anything you please.
Well, we can't, you know, buy food or alcohol for faculty.
Right. Okay.
Yes, we can support our own library. We can use it for promotional materials. We use a lot of it, in fact, to hire adjunct instructors.
Okay. And
so just to give you an example, Charlotte, this is it is a completely different thing when you're in your own school and you have a budget that is your school budget.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the computer support at Wisconsin was miserable when I was there, just horrible. Here we have our own computing technical department, mm-hmm. right, that we pay for, that fixes computers, that gets us new computers, that, you know, there is service to do our research and teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So to buy, you know, portable projectors and things that can be taken to other locations. I mean, all of this is in service of your educational and research mission.
Right.
We have our own library that we pay for by doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
With its professional staff. So I can go to the library and those librarians can actually help me do my research in a way that is very, very, very helpful.
Okay.
I'm going to give you another example. I'm sorry, I'm going on and on. We fully fund each and every PhD student for 5 years.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Okay, now, yeah, and at Wisconsin, it was always scrambling to get a little money for a couple years from somebody's research grant or some university-wide competition. It just, you know, it's no way to really build a program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is because at Rutgers you've got your own school.
Because we have our own school.
Okay. And the courses that you mentioned, the evening courses, these are part of a degree-granting program?
Yeah, they are. We have, in fact, here at Rutgers, and this is another difference, we have an undergraduate program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I have 250 undergraduate majors, and I have to, each semester, create a schedule of about 25 classes for them and other students at the university.
Mm-hmm.
We have a master's program with about 100 students, and then we have a PhD program. So it's just much bigger scale than at Wisconsin, where when I was there, the master's program entering class was typically in the range of 20,
mm-hmm.
and maybe there were 30, 35 master's students on campus at one time, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and no undergraduate program. Big state universities, I believe, and that's Wisconsin or, you know, the state of New Jersey here. In some ways, their educational mission at the graduate level is based on undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big difference.
Okay. So so to summarize what we started with, the weaknesses at Wisconsin stem from the fact that it was an interdisciplinary program, not its own school or its own department.
That's
with a budget.
Right.
And very
and it was small scale. I think it was too small scale.
Yeah, and very little
and then
autonomy.
It turned
over,
yeah.
Okay.
If I can just say it in economic terms, I think that, you know, there are economies of scale, or that there's a certain minimum size that you have to have an educational program.
Mm-hmm.
And when I initially came there, the institute was just at that minimum, and then it kind of declined.
Okay. And the do you think the decline was related to other things besides the institutional and structural factors at Wisconsin?
I think nationwide the decline in the labor movement has hurt all industrial relations programs. However, I do think that that's happened everywhere and that Wisconsin is still a state that has more unions and labor relations than many states, you know, as New Jersey is. And that in some places industrial relations programs have survived and thrived, and other places they have not because of the institutional structure.
Mm. Okay. How would you describe the relationship between the Department of Economics and the Institute?
Well, I think in the early years it was very close. When I came to Wisconsin, there were maybe 7 professors or so that were tenured in the Department of Economics whose a lot of their research and teaching was in the field of institutional economics or industrial relations, and that number dwindled over time as nationwide the two fields moved apart.
Okay. And then can you explain a little bit about how the relationship between econ and IR changed?
Well, you know, originally John Commons and the other people who started the field of industrial relations in the United States were economists. They were institutional economists,
mm-hmm.
and they were at the University of Wisconsin. And That field underwent an enormous expansion and revival right after World War II, and that's when, of course, the IR Institute at Wisconsin and most of the IR Institutes in the United States were founded because of the unionization during the 1930s and also the change in American law that and the policy issues of that era.
Oh, can you mention a couple of those?
Federal government became, of course, much more active in protecting the interests of workers. So, for example, in 1938, you have the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act with, minimum wages, overtime requirements, prohibition of child labor. You have the enactment in 1935 of the Social Security Act, which, of course, included unemployment insurance. That was something that had been promoted by the students of John R. Commons, and they were major players in the New Deal and in those kinds of laws that protected workers. So all of the great expansion in programs, social programs, we might say, that were aimed at ensuring a fair and safe workplace and income security for workers had really brought into being a series of public policy questions that involved the field of industrial relations.
Mm-hmm. So at that point, did law start playing a greater role in IR, where econ had been the predominant discipline?
I don't know. You can ask the law professors about that. But clearly, there were law professors that were very involved in the Institute from the beginning. But, law is not something that is only done by law professors. The whole field of economics and sociology, people who are concerned with public policy are concerned with law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it isn't something that's, the province only of lawyers.
Mm-hmm. But I just meant since there were these public policy changes and things like the Fair Labor Standards Act, that there might be more involvement with in terms of court cases.
Yeah, there probably were, but I can't speak to that.
Okay.
So, and I think in a later time, if I just might mention a later time, there was the explosion of public sector union representation and public sector law around, I think it started in Wisconsin 1958, about 1960, and in the 1960s in the United States. So that was another enormous wave of interest in industrial relations.
Okay. And my understanding is that in general, private sector unions have declined, public sector unions have been on the rise.
That's correct.
But even so, even with that rise in public sector unionization, there's been an overall decline in the labor movement.
That's correct.
Okay. Now what about international issues and labor issues in other countries and international students coming to Wisconsin to study IR?
Well, that's a good question. One of the strengths of Wisconsin that I didn't mention was, in fact, that it always had an international and comparative component. Students were required to take a class. And, in fact, that's not true of all the programs in the United States, many of which were more HR and orientation. One of the required classes was HR in our program, but clearly it always had an international component, and especially with the influence of the labor movement in, for example, promoting democracy in Korea, or the greater freedom in Taiwan as it developed, and then less repressive labor legislation there. There was an influx of students from other countries into the Institute who were concerned with creating those institutional laws and social structures for a more developed country with a labor movement.
So are other countries now at the point where the U.S. was in the 1930s in terms of this increased unionization and therefore a need to study industrial relations?
Some are. I think history doesn't ever repeat itself exactly the same way, but there are some parallels.
Okay. So there, the demographics of the student body may have changed a bit? over time?
Nationwide, I think that there has been an influx of graduate students into PhD programs in many disciplines in the United States, including industrial relations, although I understand that's down now with the new immigration
the post 9/11 stuff.
But yes, but I think it's true in economics. I think it's true in sociology. It's true in industrial relations.
Okay. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about you. And I guess I can infer some things from what you said about the differences between Wisconsin and Rutgers. But I wonder. What specifically, what factors led to your decision to leave Wisconsin and go to New Jersey?
Well, I think I was a rat that left a sinking ship.
Mm.
I think I could just see that these problems were not going to change, that despite years of my best efforts to convince the administration at Wisconsin to allow us to hire, to become a department, things like that, that we just were not going to be successful. And that was a very sad thing for me that went on for a very long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I eventually decided to try something else, and the move to New Jersey was a move to a bigger department, one with a less prestigious PhD program, because it's a much newer operation. It doesn't have that long brand and that history of great PhD graduate students, but it is a place that's very alive intellectually, and it's a place where you can do a lot. And so it was a sad thing for me to go, but I went to a situation that I'm actually really happy with. And the difference is phenomenal, more than I expected it to be, really.
Hmm.
I really enjoy being the chair of the department here as opposed to being director. I enjoy the creativity of having the ability to do things, to create things, and make them successful is wonderful. I mean, it's kind of entrepreneurial. It's a very different situation.
Mm. And when you were here, you were just constantly beating your head against a wall.
Well, I think Wisconsin also, and there are strengths of this. Let's see if I can explain. This is a professional school, and as I say, it's a very entrepreneurial sort of thing. Okay, Wisconsin was more of a pure research, scholarly kind of emphasis. So the total emphasis of letters and science was on getting grants to support scholarship, on having residential daytime programs for PhD students. Okay, a lot of our programs are at night. We're in a different world. This is the world of professional school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a better place to house a master's program, to tell you the truth. I don't think it's as good a place to house a PhD program in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, the terrible loss at Wisconsin is the PhD program.
Yeah. So you're happy there.
I'm very happy there. And I also like the state of New Jersey, so... I liked Wisconsin a lot, but I liked the state of New Jersey.
Okay. I remember when you were thinking about going, you said something about how you talk fast and that being close to New York would fit in with your style.
This is absolutely interesting to me because at Wisconsin I always had negative student comments on those evaluation forms about my speech, and I virtually never have that here.
Huh.
It's more like, it's definitely faster paced.
But you're originally from Washington, right? I'm Washington State, right?
So, West Coast.
So you're not a New Yorker.
No.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about what you think accounts for the gradual decline of the Institute and its ultimate closing?
Yes, I think that as institutionalists believe, that institutions matter, and that the institution, the way that industrial relations was institutionalized at Wisconsin, made sense when it was set up. But that as the world changed, that structure made less and less sense, and it could not be changed for a variety of institutional reasons. It was politically impossible to change it. And so it no longer matched, you know, what was going to work. And that institutional structure involved basically the interdisciplinary as opposed to departmentalization structure of the program. Industrial relations has moved apart from the discipline of economics nationwide and become its own discipline.
I'm wondering, though, how you said it was politically impossible to change the institutional structure, even though it needed to be changed. But there's a great deal of lip service on this campus to interdisciplinary programs.
Well, I think it's, I don't know the current situation, but in many places there's a lot of lip service. I mean, you know, universities are very traditional institutions. Things do not change quickly or easily at universities.
Hmm.
And that's just the truth. You know, it's not easy to start a new department, and it would take a large infusion of resources.
Right.
And that's what the university did not have or was not willing to commit to the program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was not just replacing the director and making that director have a tenure home in industrial relations, which, of course, was unsuccessful when the university tried to hire Adrian Eaton.
Right.
They needed to hire five or six new people,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't going to put up the money.
Right. Well, they said they would, but...
Well, right. But that's, as I said, lip service.
Yeah. But there's... And now I don't know if this may have happened after you left.
Craig Olson became director after I left.
Yeah. No, what I was going to say is there are efforts to do things in an interdisciplinary way. In some ways, it seems to be a lot of talk and not a whole lot of action.
Well, that's because industrial relations is really, this is not necessarily, it's something that could be bolstered by interdisciplinary, but you need a core of regular faculty that are fully devoted to that.
Hmm.
Okay, that's what I think.
Okay.
And that core might or might not be in letters and science. It might be in the business school. I think probably you have some faculty remaining in the business school that do labor relations and high-performance work systems and employee involvement and compensation, and all those are all part of industrial relations.
Mm-hmm.
So the core could or could not be in letters and science, but you need to have the core.
Okay. What I was going to say is that there are efforts to do things in an interdisciplinary way, but in some ways it seems to be a lot of talk and not a whole lot of action.
Well, that's because industrial relations is really, this is not necessarily, it's something that could be bolstered by interdisciplinary, but you need a core of regular faculty that are fully devoted to that.
Hmm.
Okay, that's what I think.
Okay.
And that core might or might not be in letters and science. It might be in the business school. I think probably you have some faculty remaining in the business school that do labor relations and high-performance work systems and employee involvement and compensation, and all those are all part of industrial relations.
Mm-hmm.
So the core could or could not be in letters and science, but you need to have the core if you're going to have these programs.
Right. Well, and it seems to me that there also needs to be... there need to be a lot of voices saying this is important among faculty who are not necessarily connected with it and
among
students. And that was not the case. In Afro-American studies, for instance, and women's studies, in both of those areas, there were students and faculty on campus who maybe were not teaching in those fields. They had intellectual interests elsewhere, but they felt that there needed to be scholarship and teaching devoted to those areas. And maybe they were, in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a civil rights movement and there was a women's movement,
right.
And both of them were very powerful in getting those interdisciplinary programs going. And there wasn't that groundswell of support for industrial relations.
I think that is correct. I do think it's different to start a new program where you need that kind of groundswell of support and to maintain something that you have. Mm-hmm. And to maintain something that you have, you needed more vision at the top. Mm-hmm. When you had what you had at Wisconsin, if I could draw an analogy, is really was a very valuable brand. It's kind of like Del Monte canned vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that brand has been built up over time, and it's extremely valuable. And it was built up by the fact that John R. Commons and the faculty started industrial relations, that it had a long history of graduating really eminent scholars, and nationwide had these people who were faculty at other universities that were writing and doing research. The Industrial Relations Research Association was centered in Madison, Wisconsin for that very reason. It was really a very valuable long-term reputation that hollowed out. They allowed it to hollow out. They kind of, you know, and so it really didn't need campus-wide support if they had just maintained it.
Hmm.
But instead, they let it, you know, they let it die. They didn't realize. It is extremely hard to create that. Here we're trying to build our PhD program. As I said, to do that, we have to offer students 5 years of full support. 5 years.
Right.
Think of that compared to Wisconsin, where we could get people to come for a year or two of support.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because it was a great place.
Right.
It's
right.
Hard to create something that's very prominent and highly esteemed in the academic world. It takes a long time. And basically, the administrators at Wisconsin didn't understand that, and they didn't protect their investments.
Mm. Okay. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the efforts that were made to preserve the institute. You know that
I think I knew some, and I probably don't know all of them.
Right.
But, you know.
So there was an attempt to recruit a new director.
Right.
There was a movement to move the institute into either the La Follette School of Public Affairs or the Business School.
Yeah, I know less about that. That's a good idea.
And none of those efforts panned out. I wonder if you can think of anything else that might have been done to preserve the institute.
Well, I think the question is when, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really can't comment on the end game in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wasn't there, and I stopped being knowledgeable about it, so except by, you know, hearsay or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I really think actually the move under Gerald Summers in the end of the 1970s to create a department that was, I understand, stopped after he died prematurely was the moment at which the Institute really could have been saved and become something that, you know, would be very strong and vibrant today.
Mm.
I think efforts to do it when we made an effort to be departmentalization when I was director, and it didn't get very far. And I think, you know, the economic climate was not favorable at that moment, and I think there was at that time already less support for industrial relations than there had been, say, about 1980.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, the question is when. I mean, there were different efforts at different times.
Yeah. And when Jerry Summers died, nobody stepped in and
well, you'll have to talk, the Oral History Project has to talk to Jim Stearns and other people who were present. Remember, I came after he was dead.
Right.
And I knew that after he died, people said, well, we've decided not to do this. You know, he was leading the charge, and we think maybe it's better to go forward with the interdisciplinary structure. And at that time, you know, they have a better understanding of why that decision was made than I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think the Institute should have been saved somehow, or?
Oh, absolutely. Of course I do.
Okay.
I think Wisconsin lost something really valuable, and, you know, basically it's a, you know, bracket up to stupidity on the part of University of Wisconsin administrators.
Hmm.
They didn't recognize that they had one of the very top programs in the nation, and they, you know, saved a little bit of money, and that's it.
Hmm. So there's the kind of teaching and research that were being done in IR are not necessarily being done elsewhere on this campus.
Well, I think I cannot speak to what is being done elsewhere at your university at present. I think there is some research being done in the School of Business, some being done in the Department of Sociology, and some being done in the School of Public Affairs. I mean, I'm not familiar with all of the professors who are there and all of their research programs. you know, certainly there's research in the Department of Economics that relates, and there's research in industrial relations elsewhere in the nation.
But
I think there's an enormous body of, there's an enormous body of work to do. The nature of the employment relationship is changing greatly so that there's less of lifetime employment, and many of the institutions of America that are built on lifetime employment, like pensions and health insurance and, a career with a corporation have changed. We're having huge influx of immigration. We're having a number of challenges posed by globalization. There are enormous issues in industrial relations that scholars elsewhere are continuing to work on. And, in some other areas of the University of Wisconsin, I'm sure people are playing a role in those discussions.
Mm-hmm. Well, given what you just said, the changes in careers, people no longer have lifetime careers in one place, and
or a lower percentage of people do.
People
still do.
Yeah.
There's a myth that nobody does. That's not true. But yeah, go ahead.
It certainly seems like the there are people at work, and
there is less so than there used to be, right?
And the issues may have changed. It may no longer be big labor versus big management, but there are other things that need to be studied.
Well, I think that as Joel Rogers, who's at the University of Wisconsin, and Richard Freeman demonstrated in their book, What Do Workers Want?, there still is an enormous demand for workers for voice and for some form of representation, and there still is obviously an enormous need to protect employees against abuse by employers. I think about Enron Corporation.
Right.
And how people lost their entire pensions as well as their jobs. And there are a whole host of public policy issues with regard to what the government should be doing to guarantee rights at work and adequate compensation for employees, health and safety, mm-hmm. things like that. So none of these issues have disappeared.
And
our American organized labor is struggling to reinvent itself, I think. It's down, but it's not out.
Mm-hmm. And in third world countries, certainly, the issues are exponentially worse, I think, in terms of...
Absolutely. Here this year, we've just been searching for assistant professors in two areas. One is the area of immigration and how our nation's laws and labor organizations need to change with an influx of immigration. We've made an offer in that area. We were also searching in the area of health care, which is a major employee benefit. And, of course, benefits are something that our students who are going to go into human resources want to study. And there are enormous public policy issues with regard to the provision of health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So those were, if you're active, if you're able to recruit new faculty, you can gradually change over time so that you are addressing the cutting-edge problems.
Mm-hmm. One of the courses that has been very popular here is what's termed the sweatshops course,
mm-hmm.
that focuses on outsourcing,
mm-hmm.
and items made in third world countries by big U.S. corporations,
mm-hmm.
and the horrible conditions under which people are working, the cultural differences, the language differences, the fact that people are being paid literally pennies for things that we in the U.S. are paying many, many dollars for, and it's a bleak situation for many of those folks.
Where is that course being taught?
I don't know that it's going to be taught anymore. It was Jonathan Rosenblum, who's a labor lawyer, was teaching it for IR. Oh, he taught it three or four times.
Uh-huh.
And it's, I don't think it's going to be offered anymore.
Uh-huh. Well, we have, since I've been here, we've actually started courses here in contingent and non-standard work, immigrant workers and their rights, and Latino workers in the U.S. Are all some of our new courses, and they all have a lot of student interest because they all relate to, contemporary policy concerns.
Right. So it sounds like you're in an exciting place and able to do things that you were not able to do here, which is wonderful.
I am, and I must say, I still feel that it was a great number of years I spent at Wisconsin, that there were really great faculty and students, and overall that it's a very good quality university. So I feel a lot of sadness about not being there and not being able to do this kind of thing there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you, Paula.
All right.
I'm going to turn the tape recorder off just a
okay.
sec. Okay, Paula. I'd like to circle back if you have time and go back to the original questions about why you wrote on the topic you did for your dissertation. You said it was on collective bargaining.
Well, it was union organizing.
On union organizing.
Costs and benefits. I was a student in the labor economics program at Harvard, and I particularly enjoyed Professor John Dunlop's course. I found after my father died a letter in which I had sent him as a new graduate student. I found he'd kept this letter in his desk, and the letter said something like, oh, I have this new professor, John Dunlop. He's kind of an old guy, but he tells great stories. I think I'm really going to like the class. And that's so funny, because this was right after Dunlop had left. You know, I think kind of an old guy. He was probably 64 or something. So I laugh at that. But anyway, I was one of his last students. And so I, you know, in working with him and Freeman and Medoff, I also worked as a student, a PhD student. I was paid as a researcher to help with the book, What Do Unions Do? And so I was involved in a lot of that research program, and in that there were many discussions of why unions were beset with declining union membership, and one of the questions was whether or not their failure to organize new workers was part of that. So I started on a study of union organizing programs, the resources unions had devoted to organizing, whether, you know, organizing was something unions did because it was the right thing to do, or whether it actually, you know, what were the costs and benefits to the current membership of spending resources to organize other people.
Mm.
That's how I got into it.
Oh. And as I recall, there was a Dunlop Commission?
Yes, I was a member of the Dunlop Commission. That was
this was later on.
President Clinton. Mm. It was our last attempt in this nation to have labor law reform, and it went down to defeat when the Republicans took control of Congress and Newt Gingrich became Speaker in the middle of Clinton's first term.
Mm. And what was the Dunlop Commission working toward?
We were to make recommendations to change the nation's labor laws to update them.
Oh, and what kinds of initiatives
were these? Well, these were initiatives to make it easier for employees to exercise their ability to, their right to be represented by a labor organization if they wanted to be.
Mm. Okay, okay.
But that, you know, became impossible.
I have a question I have to ask as somebody who is an English major. How did you switch from getting your BA in English to getting a master's and PhD in econ?
Well, I actually went to college wanting to be an econ major, Charlotte, but at that time there was a lot of discrimination, and I was one of two women in my class who was selected to study economics, and I remember after about a semester, my advisor in the Department of Economics asked me if I'd chosen economics because I wanted to get a husband.
Oh, my gosh.
There were virtually no women in it, and I just didn't like that. I found it very uncomfortable, and I, you know, I liked to read books. I enjoyed literature, so I dropped my econ major and became an English major.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
But then after, you know, I was out in the workforce for a year or two, my interest in economics continued, and I went back to a master's program in economics.
And what was the? What did you do? What was the job that you had after college graduation?
I worked in a organization known as Northwest Construction News. It was a trade journal. I was a reporter, though I was mostly limited to being in the office, interviewing people over the phone, and doing rewrites.
Hmm. And do you come from a union family?
My parents were both school teachers at one time, and then my father became a small business owner, and he inherited that business from his grandfather, and he had union-represented employees, but both my parents were, of course, members of the professional organization at that time that represented teachers, and that those organizations became unions historically in the 60s, and my parents supported that.
Mm. So did you grow up with labor talk around the dinner table?
To a certain extent. Western Washington is like West Virginia.
Mm.
Okay, so I grew up in a very highly unionized part of the country where unions were important, where people supported unions, where my family supported unions. I can remember their political activity. My mother was active in the Democratic Party. Unions, you know, I was from, and I was actually very surprised when I went to graduate school in Massachusetts that they were not as powerful. I think when you grow up, it's like being growing up in Hawaii.
Yeah.
It was just part of the world.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay, any other last words of wisdom for the folks who are going to be listening to this tape at some point?
Not at all. I think it's great that you're doing this project, and that I'll be interested in finding out the results of it whenever a historian decides to work with these materials.
Okay.
Okay, best wishes, Charlotte.
Okay,
thanks,
Paula. Bye-bye.